Welcome to The Read-Along,
a mini book club for your ears.
A proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network.
Locally grown, community supported.
I'm your host, Scott.
I'm your other host, Anita.
And join us on a journey through a good book,
one chapter at a time.
This episode of The Read-Along is brought to you by Taproot Edmonton, which publishes curiosity-driven stories, topical newsletters, and locally focused podcasts, all in the service of informing Edmontonians about the community. Taproot publishes a weekly arts roundup, gathering up what's happening locally in theater, dance, the visual arts, the literary arts, and much more. It's curated by Fonda Mithrush, a veteran of Edmonton's art scene and co-host of I Don't Get It, a fellow member of the Alberta Podcast Network. Subscribe to the arts roundup for free right now at taprootedmonton.ca. Always feels good to wrap a book,
right? Like a sense of accomplishment.
Yeah, 8 books now.
Oh my goodness,
we did a thing.
Yeah,
we set out to do at least one book, and now we've been doing this for over 170 episodes.
That's bonkers.
And several books deep.
Good for us.
I'm proud of us. Doing a good job.
Good job, everybody. Good job, us.
Yeah. So I guess a quick final recap of the last chapter of our novel, in which Tracker finally gets his much-sought-after revenge against Sambasam for an atrocity committed against his family.
And then some.
And then some. In which the boy finally apparently dies at the hands of Nika, surprisingly.
Right.
And then Tracker, unfulfilled and empty, wanders the land after the deaths of basically everybody involved in the story until he's picked up by the Grand Inquisitor and gives his testimony. And that is how the book came to an end.
And also loops back around to the beginning.
Yeah, because we began at the end, famously.
Yes, exactly.
That's right. And with that said, we go into our final analysis of the entire novel, Black Leopard, Red Wolf, by Marlon James. Now, before we get into the in-depth stuff, I did do a little digging between last episode and this episode, because I was curious what the sequel might be, because we were a little curious how the story might continue, seeing as we got both of the stories of the boy being sought.
Right.
And Tracker ends the story still in prison, with his fate very much in question.
Yeah, and Leopard is dead, as far as we know.
Yeah, and I was pleased to discover that apparently the sequel is going to be the same book.
Yes, but...
It's called Moonwitch Night Devil. It's coming out presumably this year. I think it has a release date for 2021.
Okay.
And it is the same story told from Sogolon's perspective.
Which should be fascinating.
Yeah, apparently the trilogy is Arashimon. And it's going to be about the same events, but told from three different points of view. And I couldn't begin to tell you who the third point of view might be, because virtually no one's left alive at the end of Tracker's version of the story.
I have an uneducated guess. I think it's Nika.
Okay. Last we saw of him, he might be dead. But, I mean, he's a vampire, so who's to say?
But if it's the same story from his point of view, he's alive until the very end.
But yeah, but presumably it's going to have the same framing device, that Tracker and Sogolon and the third person are all being interviewed by the Grand Inquisitor. And it's their version of the story to him.
Okay, maybe.
That's kind of my expectation. So if Nike is dead, he can't be giving testimony to anybody.
That's true.
But he might not be dead. Tracker's story is very much from his point of view and is very much colored by his biases and his opinions and his point of view. And it'll be very interesting to me to see how this story unfolds from basically the diametrically opposite point of view.
Yes.
Sogolon's point of view. Because she and Tracker are not friends in this story.
No.
And very much hate each other. And Tracker's description of Sogolon's actions and her motivations are going to be very different than how she would describe them herself.
Of course.
And it'll be interesting to see Tracker through her eyes. So is this going to be one of those, like, three sides of the story situation where you get your side, my side, and the truth?
Could be.
And the truth maybe comes out in the third book with a slightly less biased view of what's going on from a third point.
Oh, that'd be neat.
Yeah. This, for me, was a challenging read. I don't know necessarily about you. It was hard to get through in parts, but it was very fascinating. I found the world building to be excellent. I found myself very much getting immersed in the different kind of fantasy background that Marlon James was presenting to us, mm-hmm. rather than the more traditional kind of Western-based high fantasy, taking us to a different land with a very different aesthetic and a very different history and culture to draw upon. That was very good. It was just what was going on in the story and Tracker's point of view were very hard to stick with in some parts.
That's because of how Tracker told his story. He chose to tell it in bits and pieces, not in chronological order, and not always entirely obviously relevant.
I would imagine Sogolon will tell her story in a similar fashion, though.
Quite possibly. Or not. Who knows?
But the knowledge that it's actually Arashimon in three parts makes me more interested.
Oh, it's going to be neat.
Like, I was already kind of like, I'm curious to see where this story goes next. Now I'm actually even more interested to read the story from a different perspective. So, yeah.
So it's entirely likely that we will be reading the sequel to this?
Maybe not for the podcast, but I would be surprised if it didn't turn up on our shelf at some point.
I think this would make for a fascinating read for us to do.
On the podcast?
On the podcast.
This actually seems like as good a point to bring this up as anything. We never specifically stated that we were going to ever read a sequel to a story that we'd already read. In fact, I think our initial kind of thrust was maybe to not do that.
Yeah, that we were going to stick with one-offs.
Because we'd end up following, or just like the first book in a series, as a way to introduce a reader to maybe reading more of them. Specifically because we didn't want to fall into the trap of becoming like a series podcast, where we're just reading a series. But we really liked A Memory Called Empire, and we're very seriously considering doing the sequel. And now Nita's saying that she might want to do a Moon Witch Night Devil as a companion piece to having already done Black Leopard, Red Wolf. Now, without giving away what our next book is going to be quite yet, that's for a little later in the podcast, we do not have a sequel coming. But no. Maybe it is something to consider moving forward. Maybe you want to weigh in on that. Do you think we should read some follow-up novels to some of the series that we've kind of started?
Yeah.
Let us know.
And I'm not saying that just because we read the first book in a series that we must continue on with the series, right? But if we like the first book enough, we should consider the sequel.
Yeah.
I think. No guarantees.
No guarantees.
But maybe.
Assuming we're still around, maybe.
Maybe.
We're open to the idea.
Yeah. We're a definite positive maybe.
All right. Well, with all that said, and that long kind of preamble from me, Nita, this is technically your show, and you should be guiding the rest of the conversation here.
Everybody, now is the time to pour your wine, gather up your snacks. We're going to get all book clubby up in here. So the first thing you should always ask in any book club is, did you like it? I think it's safe to say that we did.
Yeah.
I enjoyed this book.
For sure. I found parts of it hard to get through. But overall, I was quite invested in the story. I liked the twists and turns that it took. And I'm kind of interested in seeing the same sequence of events from a completely different perspective. And in some cases, see parts of the story that we explicitly did not see in this version, which, as I recall, you even called out on a couple occasions like, oh, I wish we could have seen that. Or I wish we could have found out what was going on over there.
Yeah, I want that story.
And now we're going to get some of those stories, like what happened with Sogolon and Venon in the month that they were in Kongor while the rest of the party was lost in the Darklands.
Right?
Yeah.
Where we think Sogolon's dead to where Sogolon comes back. Yeah. There's a whole big span of time in there.
Yeah.
What happened to her then? Right? I think it would be interesting.
But circling back around to the initial thrust of the question, yes, I enjoyed it.
I did too. There were some parts of it that I found really difficult to digest. Sometimes his language got a little too flowery for me, and I had trouble keeping track of what he was telling me. And of course, I'm not a big fan of gore. The action scenes sometimes went in one ear and out the other because I just didn't want to try and vividly imagine all of that.
This is a violent book, and it's...
There's a lot of violence
in this book. Unflinching in its approach to that brutality.
Which is fine. I'm not saying it shouldn't be that way. I'm just saying it's not my favorite thing to read. But overall, I thought the story was very riveting. Let's go back to the very beginning and talk about the story a little bit. Our novel opens, as we have discussed already, at the end, right? The story of a prisoner talking to his jailer.
Yeah.
More or less.
That's the framing device for the story.
Yeah. Right? So I want to talk a little bit about how the structure of that opening affects the whole rest of the book. Because we know how it ends, right? We know he ends up in jail. We know he survives, at least to that point.
Yep.
He says right off the top that the child is dead, even though we don't know who this child is yet. And then he tells us some non-main plot stories.
Yeah, kind of setting the tone.
Yeah. How did that affect the way you read the rest of the story?
This is definitely one of those stories that's not about the destination.
That's exactly what I wrote down in my notes.
It's all about the journey.
This is all about the journey because we know how it ends.
Yeah. And because part of the overall theme of the story is that the ending didn't matter. At the end of his journey, Tracker laments that it was all for nothing. And all it resulted in was a tremendous waste.
Yes.
And that's kind of the direction that the story's going the whole way.
Mm-hmm. He succeeded in that they found the boy.
Yep.
They failed in that the boy died.
Yep.
He found love and family.
Yep.
And then lost his love and his family.
Yep.
So, yeah, it was all a giant waste of time. He's actually worse off than when he started.
Yeah.
And that is so sad.
It's it's a downer ending for sure.
It is. I suppose if you frame it the way I just did, yes, it's very much a downer ending. It's a good ending. And I don't mean good as in happy. It's a good ending because the story was so captivating. And it ends well. Not happy.
No.
But well. Okay, so let's go on and talk a little bit about Tracker and Leopard. So they're both titular characters.
Yep.
Our Tracker and our Leopard. Their relationship is, I would say, central to the plot.
Yeah.
Right? It matters a great deal. How would you describe their relationship? The only word that comes to my mind is fraught.
Yes.
Because they only kind of get along when they first meet, and then they become, like, fast friends, and then they separate for a while, and Leopard comes and goes out of Tracker's life, right? And sometimes it's great when they reunite, and other times, like, right near the end, every time he saw him, he wanted to kill him.
Well,
but he still loved him because they were friends.
That's because he was blaming Leopard for the loss of his everything.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. Like, their relationship just goes back and forth and back and forth and up and down and up and down. And they're together and they're apart. And it's very tumultuous.
And it's actually interesting because the reason Tracker is blaming Leopard in the end for the loss of everything is because he's unwilling to blame himself right up until Leopard is dying in his arms.
Yeah. He's someone else that Tracker loses.
He's projecting. It's easier to blame Leopard than to blame himself.
Yeah. I would never have left and they would never have died if you hadn't come to get me. But in the end, Tracker even admits, yeah, you came to get me, but I chose to go.
Here's a question for you. Seeing as we're seeing the story through Tracker's point of view, did he get that catharsis with Leopard? Or does he just want to believe that he got that catharsis with Leopard?
What's the difference?
Fair.
I think, if nothing else, at that point, Tracker had been through so much that he at least deserved a good goodbye with his friend.
Fair enough.
Right? He, like, give him that. Moving on, we're going to talk a little bit more about Tracker. Is Tracker the quote-unquote hero of this story? And do you trust him as a narrator? You've already said you consider him an unreliable narrator. But do you consider him the hero?
Tracker is the hero of this story, but that comes with a giant asterisk because Tracker is also the one telling the story, and we're always the hero in our own story.
Well, it doesn't have to be.
Tracker is the protagonist.
He's absolutely the protagonist, and I think you're right. I think he frames himself as the hero because he's the one telling the story.
Yes.
And no, I don't trust him as a narrator either.
I think because, Sogolon is very much positioned as an antagonist in this story. By about halfway through, she's actively messing with the rest of the crew and makes some seemingly terrible decisions that are actively harmful to the rest of them. Yet, we know that the second book is going to be from her point of view, and she's going to be the hero in her story.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we also know, we commented on this way early on in the book, how much a misogynist Tracker is.
Yeah, he's got major issues with women.
Serious issues with women. And so, of course, Sogolon is going to be painted in a negative light.
That's going to color his opinion. It's his bias. Yeah,
exactly. So I think that she has been painted for us probably worse than she actually is.
And conversely, when we hear the story from her point of view, Tracker is probably going to come off much worse than he really is.
Right?
So, to circle back around to your original question, yeah, Tracker is the hero of this story, but he's not necessarily the hero of the next story.
No, I don't think he's going to come across very good at all in the next story.
Definitely not.
Realistically, I can think of one female character in this whole book that Tracker has a positive opinion of.
And that is?
Smoke Girl.
Yeah, that's about right.
I was contemplating this earlier. I was trying to think. There aren't a lot of women characters in this book.
And that, again, might be colored by Tracker's bias against women. That he just notices women less. I suspect that in Sogolon's story, there will be more female characters.
Probably.
Especially because she spends time away from the party doing other stuff. So
yeah, but in all of that, every time we meet a woman or a girl at all who in any way crosses Tracker's path, there's really only the one that he has a positive opinion of.
Well,
everyone else he's either completely indifferent or actively dislikes.
He actively dislikes most of them, at least to start. He and Nasaka kind of come to an understanding by the end, I feel. He definitely has a poor opinion of her at first, especially because she's aligned with Nika. But before they part ways, there's kind of like an understanding between them, I feel.
To me, that felt like he went from active dislike to indifference.
He moved up to neutral.
Yeah. All right. So we've talked a lot about Tracker.
He is a big part of this story.
I know. He is our main character. But let's talk about who else we liked and why and some of the questions we still have about our other characters. Aside from Leopard, we didn't really have a character who was a constant throughout the whole book. Like, Leopard comes and goes from beginning to end. And we have our fellowship that lasts X amount of time. But not every character comes in at the beginning, and not everybody makes it to the end.
Well, even Leopard doesn't stick around for a large chunk of the book. Tracker's three most constant companions in the book, I would argue, are Leopard, Mossy, and Sadogo.
Yes, that seems about right.
And, I mean, as you say, they all come and go in various points.
Yeah.
And they all bring something different to him as well. Leopard trains him and gives him adventure. Sadogo teaches him compassion again. Like,
yeah.
Sadogo makes him realize that it's okay to open yourself up to someone. And because of that step, he's able to later fall in love with Mossy, who helps Tracker finally grow up in a way.
Which was very lovely.
And become an adult.
Yes. I really liked Sadogo.
Sadogo's a great character.
Sadogo was a fantastic character. Even before he died, like, my heart just broke for him. Because he was an Ogo, this giant who had depth and feeling, but no one ever understood that or respected that or saw that.
Sadogo is the Incredible Hulk.
Yes, kind of.
He's a big softy who just wants to be left alone. And every time he gets to know someone, they end up getting hurt. He's a man trying to get away from the monster that is following him. And in that way, he's very much the Incredible Hulk.
That's a very poetic way of putting it.
Yeah. They're cut from the same cloth, similar archetype.
I was very upset when he died, because we spent a lot of time with him. We had a whole chapter that was basically Tracker telling Sadogo's story.
We should have seen it coming, because Marlon James primed us for it with B.B. Dateman.
I know.
We got to know B.B. Dateman, and then promptly, he's dead. And so,
and it's so much worse with Sadogo, because B.B. Dateman died right away.
Yeah, but
and
that
Sadogo
was
around for a while.
That's the sleight of hand. We were scared for Mossy, like the chapter after Mossy escaped with them, and we gotten to know Mossy a little better, because we were like, oh, they get attacked by monsters, and we were on pins and needles waiting for Mossy to be the next guy dead,
right?
And then he survived. But then Mossy dies later off camera via monsters after we've gotten to know him and care about him. Sadogo gets swamped by evil shadows and dragged into an abyss, never to be seen again, after we've gotten to know him. Everyone Tracker gets to know, he loses. And B.B. Dateman was setting the stage for that, even though we didn't know it until hindsight.
I know.
So because we got to know Sadogo and Leopard and Mossy so well, naturally Tracker loses them. And indeed, in a way, at the point where we got to know Nika a little better.
Yeah, and then we lose him too.
He dies. So
he's the one I have the most questions about in terms of character holes, I suppose you can call them.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes on with Nika that is not in this story.
In this story, or that Tracker just doesn't believe. Like, Tracker mm-hmm. never trusts him from beginning to end.
Nope.
But I'm not saying I know for sure this is true, but I believe it's possible that Nika did in fact have a change of heart. And he was trying to be a better person. The problem was he had been turned into an Ipendulu and he was a monster person. And it's real hard to come back from that.
Well, I know the reason why your uneducated guess partly is that Nika's the third point of view is simply because he spends so much time on his own adventure.
Yes.
We see him at the beginning and then he and Nasaka take off. And then they come back in time to see him being all Renfielded and kill the original Ipendulu. And then he's off camera again until he comes back as the new Ipendulu. And then he has a little bit of time with Tracker towards the end. But there's a huge gap.
Oh, yeah. There's a great big chunk of Nika's story missing.
Yeah. So the prospect that the third point of view could be connected to Nika or be Nika himself is definitely enticing, especially because then we'd get to learn the truth of what happened with Tracker and the hyenas from his point of view, something that he never brings up. And I feel like he never really brings it up because he knows Tracker wouldn't believe him no matter what excuse he gives.
Also, I don't think he knows what happened with the hyenas. Well, I think he just knows that they were there.
Well, Tracker firmly believes that the hyenas were there and had gotten their hands on him because Nika had sold him out. But we don't know for sure that's the case.
Well, and
we only have Tracker's word on that.
I know.
And Nika never really confirms it. And we never hear any explanation for why he, any satisfactory explanation for why he might have done it.
No, he didn't confirm he did it. He didn't deny he did it either.
Nope.
So we genuinely don't know.
Correct.
Right? So that is a story I would be interested in. All right. I want to talk a little bit about Sogolon because we know, A, we know that she is the sequel. And B, she is a major plot drive in this book. Her quest, as it were, looms large over our story, our main plot, anyway. Yep. So what do you think about the choices she made in pursuit of this goal?
I think she made some terrible choices, which, I mean, from her perspective, might be incredibly logical.
Yeah.
But innately distrusting everybody right from the get-go was perhaps a mistake. Sacrificing Venon was nearly fatal to her. Because she gave Venon's body to someone who actively meant her harm.
Yep.
Betraying the group in Dalingo proved to be a terrible idea.
Yes.
And also nearly got her killed.
Yes.
The point is, certainly from Tracker's perspective, she makes some perplexing decisions that seem actively harmful to her own best interests, simply because she has a deep-seated, knee-jerk hatred of all of the men she's forced to work with, and inherently distrusts, and couldn't trust for even a second to maybe, like, honestly, maybe Tracker and Leopard and Nika and the rest, et al., might have been right on board, right from jump, if she'd just been like, look, here's the situation, the king's a jerk, we're trying to replace him with a new guy. The new guy's been kidnapped. Let's go save him before bad actors get him. They might all have been like, yeah, okay. Even we don't really care about the politics. That seems fine. And then there's less mistrust and betrayal later on when the truth starts to come out about what's going on. But again, just because that seems to be the case from Tracker's perspective, we don't know what's going on in her head in those moments. And we're not seeing the situation through her eyes. And knowing that we're going to find that out in the next book, a lot of those decisions that seem very self-defeating and perplexing from this side of the story might make logical sense from her side of the story.
It's entirely possible. But based on the Sogolon that has been presented to us, I want to talk a little bit about what I think her two fatal flaws are. One, her first fatal flaw is that she hates men to the point of her second fatal flaw, which is her tunnel vision, right? So she hates men to the point where she only relies on herself.
Yes.
Right? She's the only person she knows she can trust. And then her tunnel vision is what screws all this up, because she is trying to fix the world. And what happens is she's hyper-fixated on fixing the kingdom by going back to their ye old version of matriarchy,
mm-hmm.
right? And her tunnel vision causes it to change from fix the kingdom, I'm putting that in quotes,
yep.
fix the kingdom, to put the boy on the throne, which aren't the same thing.
I'm going to use a metaphor here. She frequently chides Tracker for not being able to see the forest for the trees, but she's too busy looking at the forest and can't see the trees. She's so fixated on the big picture that she's lost track of all the little stuff that's going on. And that's ultimately what kind of leads to her undoing. Because
kind of. It entirely leads to her undoing.
She's so focused on the big picture that she's not looking at how the situation on the ground is changing.
Yeah, exactly. The boy must be put on the throne, except she can't see that he doesn't belong there.
Because that's a tree, and she's focused on the forest. And and at the same time, she's chiding Tracker because he's looking at the trees and he's not seeing the forest. And because they don't like each other, they're not telling each other. She could have made things easier for Tracker by telling him about the forest, and Tracker could have made things easier for her by telling her about the trees. But because they inherently hated each other from jump,
yeah,
they could not work together, and that's probably one of the reasons why the mission failed, though it was fatally flawed from the beginning.
Oh, it was doomed from the start as soon as they lost him, as soon as they lost the boy king. I wish they'd given him a name. As soon as they had lost the boy and he was scooped up by vampires.
Oh, yeah, that absolutely scuttled everything right from jump.
Right.
And that's Bunshee's fault. That's 100% on Bunshee, from what we understand.
Yeah.
Bunshee gave the boy to the wrong person.
Yes. Lissa Solo is not entirely blameless.
Oh, Lissa Solo is very to blame for all of this.
She sent her boy away for, quote, I assume, safekeeping. They found out he was missing and no one went looking for him for years. You keep tabs on that boy. Close tabs.
Here's the thing. I think that they were keeping tabs on him up until they couldn't anymore. Because the person that Bunshee had entrusted the boy with betrayed them. And then from there, they did track the boy to the caravan that got ambushed by the vampires. And then at that point, he's in the hands of vampires who are using magic doors to crisscross the land. And he's in the wind. And I think at that point took them several years to get a beat on him again. Even to really know who had taken him.
Yeah, but as soon as you lose track of him, you start finding him. That's when they should have hired the party.
Well, my suspicion is that they were trying to find him at that point. It's just that
things finally got desperate enough that they needed to hire a party?
Yes. And I suspect that that's because, A, at that juncture, they realized they were dealing with potentially vampires and needed strong arms to help them track and kill the vampires. But also because, and this wraps back around to your original flaw of hers, she doesn't trust anybody but herself.
And she can't do it alone.
She and Lassa Solo and Bunshee, thick as thieves, probably at that juncture thought they could do it all on their own. And only after years of failure did they finally go, we might need some help. Because they seem like exactly the three kind of people who would try fruitlessly for years to track down the boy before begrudgingly bringing in some other help.
Mm.
But again, that's colored through Tracker's perspective, right?
That's true.
And in Sogolon's book, we might learn why it took them so many years to try to find the boy again. Maybe they thought he was dead up until just recently.
Oh, I suppose that's possible. This question is for you because it's kind of in your wheelhouse. What aspects of this novel feel connected to your classic fantasy? And what points are very unique?
I mean, the cultural touchstones are all unique.
Well, yeah.
But I said a couple times while we were going through that there felt like there was a lot of nods to classic Tolkien, like deliberate like winks and nods and subversions of a Tolkien-esque fantasy. And I feel like that's because Marlon James is really trying to contrast this kind of Afrocentric mythology and story with a more like Western/Norse Tolkien style high fantasy. And so I think that's why he's kind of deliberately drawing parallels there. So there was a lot of stuff. And frankly, it also makes it a little more accessible to a reader like myself, who's more steeped in more traditional high fantasy tropes and ideas. Because then, oh, well, this is familiar to me. Oh, this is familiar to you. You can grab onto that. And it helps you from getting swept away by all the stuff that's very different. A lot of the tropes and a lot of the story beats were familiar enough that it kept me in, while much of the world was very different and coming from a different headspace than the more traditional fantasy that I consume.
Good.
Your thoughts?
I'm in agreement with you on most of that. I really liked how he inserted other scenes into his story. Like, we agreed that Tracker in the library, where he meets up with Mossy for the second time, is the Indiana Jones scene.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And when he meets Mossy the first time, it's the crime detective novel scene. I really appreciated those being in there because, not because it was a trope I identified with so much as it gave the book a lot of texture.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I always appreciate that because it keeps you engaged and you're not like, okay, this is the same thing over and over again. Getting tired of hearing about the leaves on the plants. So I enjoyed that a lot, but I can't really speak because I didn't read a lot of high fantasy. Like, I read the Lord of the Rings books and that's about as far as I went.
It'll be interesting to me in the next book to have a protagonist and a point of view who's not seeing the world through their nose, but is seeing the world in tune with the spirit world. Because Sogolon's in tune with...
that's true.
With the other side in a way that Tracker's not. And Tracker is in tune with the natural world in the way that Sogolon is not. And it'll be interesting to see how that affects their voice and how they perceive what's going on around them.
Yeah. Never thought about that. That's very good. One last really quick question. Would you watch this movie?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And probably it will be a movie because Warner Brothers and Michael B. Jordan, the actor, have apparently purchased the rights to adapt it. I don't know if they're planning to adapt it as a TV series or something more akin to like Game of Thrones, or if they're looking at maybe doing a movie. Hard to say. Maybe a miniseries. Point is, it has been optioned. So, I mean, chances are very good we're going to see it, some sort of adaptation of it on screen at some point.
There's enough story here, I think, to make a miniseries out of it.
Yeah. It would be interesting if they did three seasons and they did it the way the books do it. You get the story told three ways. You could even shoot all three seasons at roughly the same time and just stagger their release. Yeah.
I would watch this movie if it was done as beautifully as it is described. I would not want to watch this movie if it's done as violently as described.
I think it would be necessarily a pretty brutal show.
Mm. I don't know if I would enjoy that part.
Fair enough. But obviously you're using this as a segue into your favorite part of our whole process.
Cast that movie!
Yeah! All right, so we settled on six characters we thought it would be interesting to cast. We've decided to cast Tracker, Leopard, Mossy, Sogolon, Sadogo, and the AC. And we realize there are some other major characters in the story that means that we're kind of leaving by the wayside, but we wanted to keep it a little short so that we're not talking for an hour.
I don't want to be here for 2 hours discussing actors.
Yeah. So, and if we do end up reading the sequel at some point, we can add like Nika in at that juncture because he'll certainly be appearing again.
Yeah.
So with that said, I guess let's kind of just jump in. Do you want to start or do you want me to start? All right, I'll go first because you're shrugging your shoulders.
Okay, you go first.
So I will start with this. I did not just want to use the entire cast of Black Panther in this movie. Easy as that would be because they are a very good cast, and I think some of them would be very good in this movie. That said, I do have several actors from Black Panther in this movie because, again, they're very good, and they're a very good cast. And they've shown that they can do this kind of material. So I think that they'd be good in that. So I think we start right at the top with Tracker. Now, you might remember I mentioned that Michael B. Jordan had optioned to this.
Yes.
I do not think that he would be my Tracker, though.
That's okay.
He's not who I pictured. When I started getting like a firm idea of what Tracker kind of looked like in my head, I started to picture Daniel Kaluuya.
I don't have a face. Hold on.
He is the star of Get Out, and he plays Wakabi in Black Panther.
Oh, okay.
He's got an intense look. He's a really, really good actor who's also got some good comic timing for some of the lighter beats in the course of the story. And he looks very much how I started to picture Tracker over the course of the story. Plus, he's a little bit younger still.
Mm-hmm.
Young enough that I think that he could play Tracker across much of the time span that he is in the story.
Yes.
So that's kind of who I pictured.
You're going to laugh at me. My Tracker is Winston Duke.
Okay.
Who played M'Baku.
Yep.
In Black Panther.
That's right.
He was buffed up for his role in that movie. I would tone him down a little bit.
Okay.
Not make him quite so big and bodybuildery. But yeah, that's who I picked. I will admit, I had a heck of a time casting this because A, I'm not all that familiar with the lengthy list of Black actors because as a middle-aged white woman, those movies are not marketed towards me. And secondly, all of the actors that I do know that I really enjoyed were all too old for what I was picturing in my head. And it's easier to age someone up in a movie than it is to
age them down.
Yeah. So I had a heck of a time. Anyway, well, that's my Tracker.
All right. Well, so for Leopard, I cast someone by the name of Winston Duke, who you might remember as M'Baku from Black Panther.
I do. I loved him. Also, he was very good.
Also in Us. I picked him because he's buffed up, actually.
For Leopard, yes, absolutely.
He's also got like he's big and intimidating. He's also got that funnier soft side, which he shows with M'Baku, actually.
Yes.
I think he has a really good look for a possible Leopard, actually. And I think he contrasts well with the person I cast as Tracker as well, giving us like two very physically different actors in those two roles.
That's funny. Clearly, Mr. Winston Duke, we both really like you as an actor.
And want you in this
movie. And we want you in this movie in one role or another.
Yeah, I had him pegged for Leopard. And again, he's an actor who I started to picture him as Leopard as I was reading.
Ah, gotcha. Cool.
Yeah.
My Leopard is an actor by the name of Michael J. White. You know him as Black Dynamite.
Yeah, I considered him, actually.
Just, he had the right look.
He's a bit older, but Leopard is older than Tracker.
But with Leopard, you're gonna have a lot of like prosthetics, whether real or digital.
Yeah.
Right? Casting him in a movie. And I think he could pull it off.
He's got a nice bassy voice too.
Exactly.
Yeah. Moving on to Mossy, Tracker's love interest.
Yes.
I went with on the one hand, this might feel like a bit of an obvious choice. I went with Marwan Kenzari. He plays Jafar in the Aladdin remake. It's probably what he's most famous for. He was in The Old Guard, which was the Charlize movie that came out on Netflix recently. And he plays a character very kind of similar to Mossy, actually.
Oh, really?
Old school fighter who's in a queer relationship. obviously, he's very comfortable playing that kind of character. He's actually Dutch. He definitely has the right look for how I think Mossy should look.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he'd be fantastic in the role. He's a very good actor.
Excellent.
Yeah.
My pick for Mossy is I hope I say this properly, Sendhil Ramamurthy.
Okay.
I brought up a picture of him. He's
very handsome.
A handsome man.
Yes.
Do you remember way, way back when a TV show called Heroes?
Yep.
He was on Heroes.
Mahinder?
Yes. He played Mahinder.
Yep. I recognized him. I was trying to reach back to get the character name.
It's
been a long time since I've seen Heroes.
I'm impressed that you remembered that. I actually had to look all of that up.
Oh, there you go.
So, yeah, I really like his look. He's a very handsome man, and I think he would play well against our Tracker.
There you go.
Our various Trackers.
Moving on to Sogolon.
My pick's a little out there.
Okay.
Diana Ross.
Diana Ross.
Diana Ross. I know. You're giving me a look. I know. But I wanted an older actress to play it. I wanted someone with like a really strong presence. And so I was looking through a list of photos, etc., and I stopped and I was like, oh, Diana Ross. Yeah, actually, I could see her playing Ye Old Witch Lady.
Ye Oldie Witch Lady. I considered Diana Ross, actually.
Did you really?
Yeah. It
feels a little off the charts, right? But
well, because I was looking for an older actor
okay.
to play Sogolon as well. Because, I mean, in the book, she's essentially described as a crone. I went with someone a little older, but maybe not completely age appropriate for Sogolon.
Okay.
My Sogolon's a bit younger. I went with Alfre Woodard.
I don't know who that is.
12 Years a Slave in Star Trek First Contact.
Oh, okay.
Two of her more notable appearances.
I think her!
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, she's good.
Yeah, I think she's underrated, actually. I think that she'd be excellent in the role. She's older without necessarily being a crone. I think she could, you could have her lose a little bit of weight and age her up a little bit, and she'd very well fit the
mm-hmm,
look.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that she would work really well for Sogolon. I think she'd be an excellent choice.
Yeah.
And she'd still have a little bit of a youthful spring to her as compared to someone very old playing Sogolon.
Yes.
Yeah. Because Sogolon is young through magic, I guess would be the best way to describe it.
Yeah, which is why I want someone who's a little older but not elderly.
Yeah.
Right? You know what I mean?
All right. Sadogo. So I did mention Michael B. Jordan had optioned this stuff, so obviously he's going to be in here somewhere. And I actually picked him for Sadogo.
Really?
Michael B. Jordan, for those, just in case you're unfamiliar, I played Killmonger in Black Panther. He was in Creed.
Yes.
He's got a wiry look, and Sadogo is not buff to me. He's huge, but wiry. And I think that Michael B. Jordan using some digital trickery and some camera trickery to make him look big, I think he'd be a really good Sadogo, actually.
Okay.
And I think he'd be able to bring some of that, like, the pathos to the character.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he'd be great in the role, honestly.
Cool.
I don't know if it's the role he'd pick for himself.
Probably not.
But I think that he'd be great in it.
Awesome.
You do some of the like Lord of the Rings Middle Earth trickery to make him look really big compared to everyone else. I think it would look real good.
Mm-hmm. I'm also going to use digital trickery, but on the other end of the scale.
Oh.
Because I have cast someone who I think should be cast in all the movies all the time forever.
Okay.
Idris Elba.
Okay, fair enough.
Because, and I think you digitize him to be big and lanky.
Yeah.
Right? But I think he can pull off the sadness and the pathos, right? Just the dreariness of Sadogo's existence. I think you need a very, very good actor for that. And I happen to think that Idris Elba is a very good actor.
Oh, like top 10 living actors, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, he's amazing, and he should be in all the movies all the time forever.
I agree. I did not cast him in the movie. Though, that's not to say that if we weren't casting every part in the movie, that I wouldn't have found something for him.
Oh, absolutely.
Actually, he'd probably be good as the Griot.
Maybe. Can he sing?
Oh, I have to believe he can.
It just makes him better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And lastly, we've got the AC.
I wanted the AC to be older.
Okay.
Someone who can play crazy but actually really smart.
Okay.
And I wanted a big name for it because it's actually a smaller role. I picked Forrest Whitaker.
Yeah, okay. I see that.
Yeah?
I definitely see that. He'd look fantastic with just a big shock of red hair, too. And he's got a like a nice voice for kind of some of the just mean things he says in the course of this. I see it. Actually, that's an interesting choice. It's not one I considered. I considered someone younger than Forrest.
That was my one pick that I was actually really proud of. It was the first person that came to mind when I was thinking about the AC.
Fair enough. I went with Mahershala Ali. He's in The Hunger Games and in Luke Cage.
Okay.
He's got a really good look for how I think AC should just kind of look.
Okay.
I think he'd also look delightful with a shock of red hair. He's got a bit of a darker complexion, which also works for AC, who's described as just having like night black skin.
Oh, yeah. Very, very dark.
And I think that he's just an excellent actor and an actor who can bring a little bit of mystique to it.
So, nice.
Yeah. So I went a different direction than you. You went with someone a little older. AC, to me, kind of falls into the same realm as Sogolon, as someone who's clearly using magic to keep themselves looking the way they want to look.
Fair enough.
So someone like kind of a little more sexy,
mm-hmm,
was kind of the direction I was going with that.
That's fine.
Yeah.
So there we go.
There we go. We casted the movie.
We done did casted.
Yeah.
We did it. One more down.
One more down. And that means it's time once again to crack open a new book.
Do you hear this, everybody?
The sound of a new book.
That is the sound of a new book.
It's got new book smell and everything.
Fresh book smell.
Yeah. So we threw up our poll and people voted. And the votes that came through were for horror genre, which is a genre we have not revisited since our very first novel.
Yeah.
Because our first novel, Meddling Kids by Edgar Cantero.
I suppose technically counts as horror.
It is a, you find it on the shelf in your horror section. It is a light horror story. And Nita's a big softie, so we went with another light horror story.
It found me horror with funny in it.
It is horror with funny in it.
Hope has a price. This is the blurb on the back. It starts with hope has a price. Nick Prasad has always enjoyed a quiet life in the shadow of his best friend, child prodigy, and technological genius, Joanna Johnny Chambers. But all that is about to end. When Johnny invents a clean reactor that could eliminate fossil fuels and change the world, she awakens primal, evil, ancient ones set on subjugating humanity. From the oldest library in the world to the ruins of Nineveh, hunted at every turn, they will need to trust each other completely to survive. Read-alongers, we give you Beneath the Rising by Premi Mohammed.
Yeah. The first time, in fact, on our podcast that we are featuring a local author to us.
Completely by accident.
Yeah. Premi Mohammed is an Edmonton-based writer.
Yeah.
So it'll be exciting to delve into her work here.
And we didn't know that until after we had selected this book and made purchase and brought it home.
Yeah. So you'll want to read up on chapter one of Beneath the Rising in time for next week. Should be available wherever you can get a book. And if you can't find a physical copy of it, readily available in a digital version, pretty much wherever you might be able to get a digital version of
it. Oh, yeah. We try to pick books that are easy to come by so that everybody can get them and read along with us.
Yeah.
That's kind of the point.
That's right.
Yeah.
So with that said, we'll wrap up here in our, as usual, slightly longer analysis episode. And in the meantime, you can check out the following podcast of one of our affiliates.
Hello, I'm Elizabeth Bonkink.
I'm Andrew Paul.
And we're the hosts of the Well-Endowed Podcast.
The Well-Endowed Podcast is produced by Edmonton Community Foundation, or ECF as we call it.
ECF provides grants to charities through the endowment funds we create and manage with our donors.
Hence the title of our show, The Well-Endowed Podcast.
Every month, we bring you a collection of stories and interviews with fascinating guests who are working to make Edmonton a strong, vibrant city to live in.
Through these stories, we look at the space where endowments intersect with your communities.
So if you're interested in the people and issues impacting your community, check out the wellendowedpodcast.com.
Well-Endowed Podcast. Great people.
Oh, yes. We've shilled for them before.
And we shall shill for them again.
Absolutely.
Because they are continuing longtime supporters of the Alberta Podcast Network. You, too, can be a supporter of the Alberta Podcast Network just by going and checking it out.
Yeah.
Listen to the podcasts that are available. You can find a full listing of them right now at the website, albertapodcastnetwork.com. Guaranteed there's something there besides just our podcast that will tickle your fancy.
Absolutely. While you're there, you might consider giving us a rating and a review.
Maybe not on the website for the podcast network, but where you go to download your podcast.
Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped a step.
That's okay.
That's my bad.
Too late for carrying on. You can also check us out on social media.
Oh, this one I know. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Goodreads. We are at The Read Along on most of those.
And you can also reach us via email.
I know this one too. TheReadAlong@gmail.com.
And with that said, as always, we love you very much. We'll see you next time.
New book smell.
Will the Lovecraft box be coming back?
Ooh, maybe.
Thank you for joining us on The Read-Along with your hosts, Anita and Scott Bourgeois. A proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, all read-along music is by Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com. Cover art is by Aaron Beaver. Be sure to join us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at The Read-Along, and check out our group on Goodreads.com.